From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, lawmakers want to relax penalties for concealed pistol holders who carry in a gun-free zone.
If somebody had a violation in 1970 and then has another one again in 2019, they probably shouldn't have to get a second or a third offense, and there should be some sort of look-back period.
That balloon you've released could kill an animal.
That breaking down of the balloon might take years, depending on the environmental conditions. So during all that time that it's there, it can be a potential hazard.
Halal Metropolis, showing how Muslims are present in public spaces.
The accommodations, the artifacts, the streetscapes, the signage, the architecture, the design, the food, the culture.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, Halal Metropolis, an exhibit opening this weekend, showcases Muslim contributions to art, music, culture, and so much more in Southeast Michigan. We'll find out more later in the hour. But first, state lawmakers are considering a package of bills that would ease penalties on concealed pistol license holders caught carrying in gun-free zones. This is the result of compromise, bipartisan cooperation. State Representative Bo LaFave is a Republican from Iron Mountain. He chairs the Military Veterans and Homeland Security Committee, which oversaw the bills. Representative, welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
So before we talk about what is in this set of bills and how penalties would be decreased, let's talk about how you did this. So the bills that were referred through the House Military Committee were worked on by members from both parties. So we're going to hear the result of bipartisan compromise?
Absolutely. Couldn't have done it without Vice Chairman Jones of the committee, as well as Representative Churkin, and of course the members on my side of the aisle, to come together to do criminal justice reform that applies to concealed pistol license holders who accidentally cross into pistol-free zones. And this will severely limit the amount of prison time that they have to serve, as well as right-sizing the criminal justice system.
So the reshape bills spell out, first time a CPL holder is caught carrying in a gun-free zone, it's a civil infraction with a $275 fine. Second offense within 5 years means you would lose your CPL and would be a misdemeanor that could get you 90 days in jail. Third offense, a felony with 2 years in prison. Sound right?
That's right.
So how do these reshape bills differ from the original version? What was the penalty there?
The original version would have eliminated the second and third offenses and made them a $100 civil infraction every time, regardless of the number of times an individual went into a CPL zone, a pistol-free zone with a CPL. And I spoke to the members on the other side of the aisle and to try to find a way to move forward in a bipartisan manner. And the biggest thing for my side of the aisle and that the other side agreed to is that, you know, if somebody had a violation in 1970 and then has another one again in 2019, they probably shouldn't have to get a second or a third offense, and there should be some sort of look-back period and limit the amount of time you go back in time and look at previous offenses.
So that five-year reset was very key.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I want to do this to more than just these bills, but looking at criminal justice and habitual offenders all together and try to use this as a starting point for other offenses as well. Because when you start habitualizing offenders, you're talking about adding 5 or sometimes 10 years to each offense that they committed. And if somebody, you know, might have committed a bad crime a decade ago and then they do it again, you know, 20 years after they did it the first time, are they really a habitual offender? Should we use that one previous mistake and really get them on the second one? I think a period of time of look back of 5 or 10 years is reasonable.
And we should note all of those penalties proposed in this package are all lower than current penalties. But you did tell the news service Gongwer that no Republicans thrilled about regulating CPL holders. So why are these bills a win from your perspective?
Well, it's a win because, well, frankly, Article 1, Section 6 of the Michigan Constitution says every person has the right to keep and bear arms for the defense of himself and the state. So it is, in my opinion, concealed pistol and pistol-free zones are in and of themselves unconstitutional. But if we can limit their negative impact on law-abiding citizens. That's a win.
Gun-free zones certainly have drawn the ire of many pro-gun legislators over the years, as you've just indicated. Are there any efforts afoot to further alter restrictions on gun-free zones or what can be considered a gun-free zone?
Yeah, I have bills that were the third bill that I introduced this session that would eliminate pistol-free zones for concealed pistol license holders. To get a concealed pistol license in Michigan, you need to go through a federal background check, fingerprints on file with the FBI, go through 8 hours of training and be a law-abiding citizen. So restricting them, I don't think, is helping public policy or public safety. So I introduced that bill earlier this year.
And where is that?
That is sitting before the House Judiciary Committee, where I am the vice chair.
All right. So, Representative, as we've seen over the years across the country, innocent people have died from gun violence while at school, in places of work and worship, at shopping malls, movie theaters. That list goes on. How do we, as a society, go about making everyone safer from gun violence?
Yeah, the best way to do that is to stop law, is to not prevent law-abiding citizens from carrying their weapon with them in pistol-free zones. 98% of mass shootings occur where the government or private entities have disarmed law-abiding citizens. And the folks that want to commit gun violence are cowards. And 9 times out of 10, as soon as a bullet flies towards their direction, usually from an officer, they immediately stop shooting people and commit suicide. These are cowards that go into pistol-free zones because they know the civilian population is unarmed and there's no one to shoot back at them. So the best way to stop children and law-abiding citizens from being murdered in these pistol-free zones is to get rid of them and allow trained law-abiding citizens to defend themselves everywhere in our state, which is what I believe the Constitution said we should do in the first place.
Representative, are you a CPL holder?
I am.
And why is that?
I think that it is important to protect the state. I think the women and men of law enforcement do a fantastic job. Unfortunately, there's just not enough of them, nor ever could there be, for them to be everywhere in every place in Michigan where something could happen at every minute of the day. So I want to be able to defend myself, my family, my colleagues, and the people that I work for, and the citizens of Michigan at large, from people who would do us harm.
So back to this package of bills we've been talking about that would ease the penalties for CPL holders caught carrying in gun-free zones. What's next for this package of bills?
This bill's moved to the House Judiciary Committee for concurrence, and then they'll move directly to the House floor for full consideration of the body.
GOP State Representative Bo LaFave, who chairs the Military Veterans and Homeland Security Committee. Representative, appreciate your time. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. It was an honor and a privilege.
Just about a month to go before Detroit's automakers begin national contract talks with the UAW. And there will be a long shadow looming over the Fiat Chrysler bargaining table: corruption. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes, the federal prosecution of auto industry figures is 2 years old. What has it revealed?
Well, it's revealed a pattern of corruption at the highest levels of the UAW's FCA department and its joint training center and among some top executives at Fiat Chrysler. And just this week, Fiat Chrysler, the Detroit News reported that Fiat Chrysler is in the middle of negotiations with the federal government to essentially settle their role in the case that would end the prosecution or potential prosecutions of any additional FCA individuals. And also, one of the sticking points is that FCA does not want to admit any guilt as part of the settlement. So they are continuing the negotiations. We do have this confirmed. I don't think there's any doubt that this is happening. But I think it then raises the question about where does this stand with the UAW? Because the feds have, in some of their filings, finally alleged that a conspiracy between the company Fiat Chrysler and the union UAW, not just individuals, but that it was an institutional conspiracy on the part of those two entities. So you have to assume, at least I think it's safe to assume, that the UAW is likely going to be faced with the same situation the FCA is, and do they try to cut an institutional deal, and I'm just using that in the generic sense,
right,
an institutional deal with the federal authorities.
If Sergio Marchionne had not died last summer, could he have been at risk of federal charges?
I think based on our reporting, the answer is probably, I don't want to say definitively, but it appears that he was, and this is recounted in our story that was published on Wednesday, that he was asked by federal investigators whether he had given a watch to a former vice president of the UAW, now deceased. He said no, and they then presented him with evidence in front of his lawyer to suggest that, in fact, he was not telling them the truth. Now, where that would have gone, we don't know. We had heard last year that there were more, quote, big fish that were likely to be landed as part of this whole thing. And, of course, a lot of us assumed, those of us that were covering this story, that Sergio Marchionne might be one of those individuals. It's interesting that some of the people most implicated in this, two of the principals, have since died. One was the vice president of the Fiat Chrysler Department of the UAW, General Holyfield, and then, of course, Marchionne, who would not, we don't know what would have ultimately happened and whether they would have indicted him for giving somebody a watch.
And we've seen, what, 8 convictions already?
Mm-hmm.
More to come, possibly? More names to be announced?
Well, I think part of what we think, potentially, yes. But I think what the assumption that we're operating under at this stage of the game, based on our reporting, is that it's likely to be from the union side. We think that there are a number of other former officers who are at least being looked at, and we've reported that authorities have, quote, expressed interest in speaking with them about issues. The fact that a number of people who have already been convicted are still not in jail in any way, shape, or form would suggest that they may be continuing to cooperate with prosecutors.
Bottom line, if I work on the line at an FCA plant, what does this all mean to me?
Well, I think what it means is this certainly suggests that the leadership was far more interested in working for themselves than representing the interests of people on the shop floor. And that has been a concern of the rank and file for a very long time. And I think that that is something that is in play here. You know, they have for a long time had said that any monies or anything that had been taken, any ill-gotten gains, was FCA corporate money, because FCA is what funds the Joint Training Center. We've since reported, my colleague Rob Snell has reported extensively on the use of union money for conferences out in California. Every January and February, they spend a long period of time out in Palm Springs, which it's interesting to note they're not in Flint or, you know, Louisville, Kentucky. They're in Palm Springs and charging that back to the union. And that, reported in their own filings, is union money.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. As always, thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
Up next, 18,000 pieces of balloons have been found around the Great Lakes. We'll hear about the impact on the wildlife and environment after the break. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. You know the old rule, what goes up must come down. And when balloons are going up, their inevitable descent to Earth is polluting our environment and killing animals. Keith Matheny is the environmental reporter for the Detroit Free Press, and Laura O'Brien is a grad student at the University of Michigan School for Environment and Sustainability, where she's doing research on balloon waste. Great to have you both with us. Keith, your recent front page story on balloons right there in the Free Press, the headline in your Free Press story, 18,000 pieces of balloon waste were found in the Great Lakes. And I know that was between 2016 and last year. So you stop and you think, we're at a football game, we're at a memorial service, and we release a colorful bunch of balloons. And then tell us what happens when these balloons and their strings get back to Earth.
The thing that I don't think anybody really thinks about is literally 100% of released balloons come down as litter somewhere. While the balloon industry will tell you that latex balloons, for example, are biodegradable, that breaking down of the balloon might take years depending on the environmental conditions. So during all that time that it's there, it can be a potential hazard. The colorful balloon and its string, when it's in the water, can look like food to a bird, to a marine mammal. You know, off the coast of the ocean, they're having problems with sea turtles and dolphins, you know, eating it. And talk to some folks at U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service who you know, when they do a necropsy on a dead animal, we'll find just pieces of balloon and balloon string all wrapped throughout its guts.
Okay,
so
that is
really bad stuff.
Awful to think of. And Laura, you're actually using volunteer spotters to help you track balloon waste?
Yeah, no, I've been aware of the problems of plastic pollution and balloon releases. And I became aware of Alliance for the Great Lakes. They have a great Adopt a Beach program where they have volunteers go out and collect waste, and then they separate and count the different kinds of waste that they find.
So you actually ask the public, if you're out, you know, walking on a beach in the Great Lakes,
yeah,
let me know if you find a piece of balloon.
Yeah, exactly. I've always been interested in having citizen science and having volunteers collect data.
Give me an idea how far this debris's gone.
It's reaching into as
up
far
to Thunder Bay.
Yeah, and like there was a balloon found on Isle Royale. Mm-hmm. There's Lake Superior, Lake Michigan, Lake Huron, Lake Erie. It's far reaching.
So and it's interesting as your piece for the Free Press, Keith Matheny, tells us 5 states have limited or banned intentional balloon releases.
Yes.
8 other states are considering balloon laws. But Keith, Michigan, not any of the Great Lakes states are on that list. Why is that?
No, I just think this hasn't been an issue that has yet kind of gotten into people's consciousness to any great extent. It does not surprise me that a number of the states that have adopted this are sort of Atlantic coast. Florida is one, for example. People who are probably seeing it on the ocean shores and seeing the impact of it on a fairly regular basis. Maybe it's, you know, California, for example, also is one of the states that's taken action on this.
But in fairness, Tennessee is not on the ocean. It's on a coastline, and Tennessee has done this.
I can't explain to you why the good folks in Tennessee jumped on board with this, but bully for them.
Now, I know the Balloon Council, as I learned in your story in the Free Press, Keith, it's spending money to block or change balloon release laws. So this is the trade industry for the balloon makers.
Believe it or not, there's a balloon lobby, and it represents the makers, the manufacturers, the distributors. And one of the things that they told me is they're amenable to release bans, although that's a recent development, because what I'm told in years past, they were basically opposed to everything. Mm. Now I think they see the way the tide is going, and they're saying, well, we agree and have no problem with bans on releases, but we do not like bans on balloons. We want to be able to keep those industries going because there's a lot of little gift shops, mom-and-pop type stores that would be harmed if you did an out-and-out ban on balloons.
Keith, what's at stake here?
Well, it speaks to the larger issue we're having with plastic pollution in our waterways all over our planet, right? It's one of those things that when you really stop and think about it, and I was among those who never did, 100% of released balloons end up as litter. As one person in my story put it, you wouldn't go outside and dump a box of deflated balloons on the ground. That would seem very illogical. That would seem blatantly like littering. Yet if you release a balloon, fast forward, and that's happening. It just seems like you mentioned, one of those common sense things that eventually will come around to.
Mm-hmm. Keith Matheny, environmental reporter for the Detroit Free Press. You will find his story there on the free.com website. And then Laura O'Brien, who's a balloon waste researcher and a grad student at the University of Michigan School for Environment and Sustainability. Thanks to both of you.
All right, thank you.
Thanks very much.
And if you're planning on enjoying the Great Lakes or tributaries this summer, you can participate in Laura's Balloon Waste Survey. We've put a link for you at michiganradio.org. Jazz trumpeter Etienne Charles explores the ritual and celebration of Carnival in his native Trinidad in his latest album. It's titled Carnival, the Sound of a People. Charles is also an associate professor at Michigan State University. Stateside's Mercedes Mejia sat down with him to talk about what inspired his project.
Etienne, thanks for coming in. It's good to have you here.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
So when I think of Carnival, I think of Brazil, of course, with their huge parades, the dancing and rhythmic drumming and sort of elaborate costumes. And in some countries, you know, people wear scary masks and costumes, large bells that clang and drive out evil spirits, in a way announcing the end of winter and beginning of spring. And all of this somehow invokes a kind of trance in people, right? And I'm wondering about the origins of this project and what inspired you to study carnival in your homeland of Trinidad.
Well, you hit on a very strong word there with respect to trance and transformation. And this project came out of a few things. One, it was a way for me to kind of do an in-depth research into not just what carnival was and is, but what about what caused it to be like that. And it actually turned into like a history study almost, because through the culture and through the current state of art in carnival, it became a study. It showed how the history affected it, because carnival is basically a dialogue. In Trinidad, it's a dialogue that a society has between itself and its past and its present and also its future, because it's like you can kind of draw lines. And so it ties in all of these different influences from West Africa, from European settlers, and not just European settlers, but also specifically colonialism and the resistance to that, and as well as many different. I mean, Trinidad is inhabited by people originally from India, people originally from China, people originally from Syria and Lebanon. So there are all these different influences as well that they're going to making up the population of the island, in addition to making up the art and culture. So this project kind of really just tied in all of these things. And for me, it was a way to learn about the magic that causes people to transform from their day-to-day state of, this is me at work on Thursday morning at 9 a.m., this is me leaving work Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m., to then what caused them to transform from that to Ajab Malassi.
Well, let's talk about that, because that's the first track off your album. And it centers on a blue, fire-breathing carnival character. Tell us about this character and its relevance.
So the folklore behind Ajab Malassi is that it's the vengeful spirit of a slave who met its death in a cauldron of boiling molasses, which was one of the ways that slaves were tortured specifically in the colonies that were inhabited by French planters. Like Ajab Malassi is a French Creole term. Ajab comes from the French word for devil, which is diable, D-I-A-B-L-E. And then Malassi comes from melas, M-E-L-A-S-S-E. In Spanish, it's melaza, which is French or Creole for molasses, which was, at the time, sugar was the main crop, specifically in Trinidad, that was being exported. So what it is, it's a theatrical depiction of all things to do with suffering, but it's also, there's a huge overtone of vengeance, there's a huge overtone of parody, because there's a very almost comical dance that they do, even though they have these very, their eyes always become extremely intense. They hit on these biscuit tins, and when they hear that sound, it's that wood hitting metal, they start transforming, and they don't actually get into costume or character until they hear that rhythm. So while they're getting ready to perform, they have to have the soundtrack playing. They have to hear it, like, in there. And it's just the beating and they're singing. Like, if you let them, when you hear the track, you hear random screams going on. Because that was just, I just recorded them. I didn't do anything. I didn't make any loops or anything. That's just them and their screams and their shouts. And once they hear that, that's when they transform, and then they climb up these greasy poles, and
And they paint themselves in these videos that you have. Mm-hmm. You know, you see them sort of transforming, and you can hear it through the music itself. Yep. And then you come in with the trumpet.
Mm-hmm. Because I wanted
to bring a different element.
Well, I wanted to copy the sound. I wanted to copy with the melody the sound of the scream. The sound of the doubt. The sound of being in a new place. Like, what does it sound like for somebody from the afterlife, from 200, 300 years ago, from the underworld? What is it like for them to be in 2019?
from what I understand, you recorded samples of them drumming, and there's chanting and some of the songs as well. And did you find that people were open to collaborating with you in this way, in this project?
People were, for the most part, people were open. Everybody was receptive. Everyone was receptive. Some were a little cautious at first, specifically with respect to Black Echo. One of the groups was a little cautious. You know, they said, well, you know, we have a sample that has been done that you could just buy the sample and put it on a keyboard, and then you could record that, and then you could use that however you like. And I was like, yeah, but I'm not recording samples. I'm not. This album is about people. This album is about the energy that music gets, and it channels, and the dialogue that happens between musicians and their ancestors when they play. And so once they understood where I was coming from, they were like, okay, yeah. So then all of a sudden they had all these ideas about how we were going to record and what they wanted to do. And so.
So let's talk about another character that you explore in this album, Moku Jumbi.
Moku Jumbi. So Jumbi. Moku Jumbi is a really old tradition in the African diaspora. You see stilt. Some people call them stilt walkers. You see them on these high stilts.
You see them in Cuba.
You see them in Cuba. Yeah, you see them in St. Croix. Yeah. You see them all over. Mm-hmm. And it really dates back to Africa. And in Trinidad, Moku Jumbi, you know, we call it African nobility reimagined. But a lot of times the story goes, because, you know, there are different parts of folklore that tell different stories, of course, because over 200-400 years, stories kind of change. But the story that resonates with me the most is that the Moku Jumbis we see are the Africans that used their height to walk across the Atlantic to come and rescue their brothers and sisters who had been kidnapped and captured and sold across the Atlantic. And that's the story that really resonates with me when I think of it. And the way I wrote the music, it's like there's like this ostinato bass line, and then the horn line kind of goes up. And I was trying to replicate the idea of looking up, like specifically like a child, a short child, looking up at this tall Moku Jumbi and what it sees. And then also when the Moku Jumbi starts to dance, because they, you know, they pick up one of their legs and they like lean back and they do all of these crazy moves. And so I wanted to capture that sonically, so that like the piece moves all through these different modes. So that's the Moku Jumbi.
Your students at MSU can learn from this project and your approach to music?
From this project? many things. One, that don't box yourself into one thing. Be really open to what you can learn from other cultures, and be really open to learning the ins and outs of your own culture. You know, we live in a time when because of imperialism and nationalism, in a sense, people are kind of boxed in and categorized based on like exactly where they're born. Mm-hmm. And so what it does is it takes away the concepts of migrations and immigrant experiences. So like, even though I'm from Trinidad, my great-grandfather's from Martinique, my great-grandmother's from Montserrat. You know, I have one of my great-grandmothers, her family's from Venezuela. She's Warao. So, you know, it immediately changes things to understand, okay, well, yeah, but we're African from Trinidad, but it's like there's all these other things at play. Same thing with wherever people are from. So, you know, I always encourage my students to get in touch with their roots, understand the grooves, understand the musical traditions, understand the food, understand what rituals have what type of music with them, and then be as creative as possible with respect to how you compose and how you tell these stories. Because that's one way that we could connect as a people more, is by understanding, you know, for me, the easiest way to learn about a culture is through their music, their food, their clothes, their rituals, their architecture, you know, what type of jewelry they wear and why, their language. And all these are arts. And so that what I hope that my students can learn from projects like these that are kind of a little out of the box, especially when you speak of terms that people call jazz, is really out of the box. But it's, for me, it's my most at-home project because it's the one where I connected with the most people where I am from.
Well, you can find out more about this project and other music from Etienne Charles at etiennecharles.com. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me. It's been so much fun.
Etienne Charles will be performing tomorrow at the Summer Solstice Jazz Festival in East Lansing. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Coming up, Halal Metropolis, an exhibit that shows Muslim contributions to art, music, culture, and so much more in public places in Southeast Michigan.
It's great to be able to have a hub where people can come together and appreciate, you know, all of the creative expression that all these Muslims have from different backgrounds.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Frogs and toads are especially sensitive to the degradation of their habitats, so it makes them a good barometer of environmental health. Every year, volunteers throughout Michigan do a listening survey to find out which species of frogs and toads are present and how abundant they are. Cheryl Bartz of Red Pine Radio wrote along with volunteer Kathy Gray on Old Mission Peninsula.
Well, I do love the toads. I love the trilling toads. I'm Kathy Gray. I'm a retired nurse practitioner in Traverse City area, and I'm involved in the Department of Natural Resources Frog and Toad Survey in Michigan, and have been doing this with my spouse for the past 6 years. It started out as kind of a date night, you know, let's get a pizza and let's go out and listen to frogs. And then we found out that there was a way that you could actually be helpful and to make a difference for the environment and for, you know, little creatures that we both really care about. And it feels good to be doing something. These are spring peepers. Generally on our route, this early in the spring, we hear maybe as many as 4 different species. You're estimating the number of frogs on a 0 to 3 scale. 0 meaning you don't hear any voices. If you hear so many frogs, like we're hearing here, you hear so many peepers here that there's no break in the action, that denotes a 3. And then anything in between is either a 2 or a 1. Frogs are a very exquisitely vulnerable species, and so to see the waxing and waning from year to year of the particular species and the particular environment that they are in has really kind of been dramatic. They built a church out here, a big church, and the area where we had been listening to frogs, which is considerable distance behind this church, for 3 years in a row, we essentially heard no frogs whatsoever. I wept. I just thought, oh no, they're gone. They're gone. But you can hear now that there's quite a few peepers. There's a lot of toads tonight. What was dead wetlands to these amphibian frogs 3 years ago is now back.
That piece was produced by Cheryl Bartz. Exploring the ways Muslims are visible in Southeast Michigan. That's the goal of a project called Halal Metropolis. The exhibition's a project of the University of Michigan Dearborn's Center for Arab American Studies, and it is opening Friday in Detroit. And here with us is one of the three creators of Halal Metropolis, Razi Jafri. Good to see you. And I'm going to say see you back because you were with Stateside for a while as one of our production people, and it's good to see you.
It's great to be back. Thank you for having me.
And we also welcome Tazeen Ayoub, who's founder of the Detroit chapter of GAMA, which means Gathering All Muslim Artists. It's an artist collective, and it's so good to see you here, too. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Razi, what are people going to see when they turn up starting this weekend at Indus Detroit?
Well, when people come to the exhibit, they're going to see artwork created by Muslim artists. Halal Metropolis is an exhibition series focusing on Muslim visibility in Southeast Michigan. So the other two co-creators of the project are Usman Khan, who is an artist, and he's the chair of the MFA at the University of Michigan Stamp School of Art and Design, and Professor Sally Howell, who's a historian at the University of Michigan Dearborn. So we did a call for submissions several months ago to Muslim artists. We knew that this exhibit was coming up. You know, we were going to launch it in the summer of 2019. And in order to have a fuller story about Muslims in the area, we wanted to have an open call for Muslim artists to submit work and to think about this idea of visibility and what it means to them. So we have artists from different backgrounds. We have performing artists, we have visual artists, photographers, and different types of artists that will have contributed work to this exhibit. Then the exhibit continues. It's a multi-part exhibit. So after that, we'll acquire and curate work from other Muslim artists in the area as well.
So it's going to be kind of ever-changing. And as we're going to explore a little bit later on, you're going to be kind of moving around with this exhibit. What did you learn as you explored the pieces that these artists submitted? What did that concept of visibility mean to people?
So when we talk about visibility, really, and connecting it to what it is to be a halal metropolis, and it's a region in which Muslims can live freely, practice their faith, contribute to society with all of their creative and entrepreneurial and all kinds of skills that they have. And Detroit in Southeast Michigan happens to be a place that we can describe as a halal metropolis. And some of the things that I can mention as examples in terms of what makes it a halal metropolis are the accommodations, the artifacts, the streetscapes, the signage, the architecture, the design, the food, the culture, all of which lead to this visibility. So visibility through all of these different elements. Those elements are created by Muslims, but sometimes those elements are also created by non-Muslims. So if you were to go to a Kroger's, or if you were to go to a Whole Foods or Meijer's or Home Depot, you would see signage in the stores congratulating people on Ramadan or wishing people a happy Eid. At Home Depot, you might find signs in Arabic. And so there are ways in which Muslims create this visibility through creating businesses that are accommodating and targeting the Muslim community. But then there are also businesses that are owned by non-Muslims, often big corporations, that are targeting the Muslim community as well. So in a way, they're participating in what we would call a halal marketplace, which is part of the larger halal metropolis.
And why did you want to put this on and put this all out there?
We wanted to bring this exhibit to life because it's one of the things that when we think about Muslims, when we think about immigrants, when we think about other ethnic or religious minorities, we tend not to think about their contributions. And I often tell people that with the halal metropolis, once you see it, you can't unsee it. You know, and so once you start thinking about these artifacts, the signage, the storefronts, it plants a seed in your head and you're able to see that, particularly in this case, our work is focusing on the Muslim community, but you see a presence, a visibility that's there and that is inseparable from the larger society in the area.
Tazeen, why did you want to be a part of this?
Well, I think it's such a great endeavor to showcase Muslim artists. You know, there's so many artists, especially in this area. He mentioned there's performing artists, visual artists, dancers, painters, you know, photographers, graphic designers. And it's great to be able to have a hub where people can come together and appreciate, you know, all of the creative expression that all these Muslims have from different backgrounds.
Which completely fits in with the mission of Gathering All Muslim Artists.
Exactly.
So as you've launched that. One of the goals, I know, is to take this exhibition to parts of the state, let's say like Howell, parts of Macomb County, where perhaps there's not as much exposure to Muslim American people and culture. So what would people who have a limited understanding or awareness of Muslim American culture be surprised to see?
Yeah, we wanted to go to places like Macomb County and Howell and possibly in the future other areas where there's not as much visibility for the Muslim community, or the visibility manifests itself in the form of Islamophobia or some other type of tension or discrimination. And so we wanted to go to these places to build bridges with the communities. And one of the surprising things that we experienced was, perhaps it's not so surprising, but the galleries that we worked with in Macomb County, the Anton Art Center, and in Howell, Cleary University, was the response was very positive and very strong in terms of the galleries themselves wanting us to have the shows there. And so I think...
So you felt welcomed.
We felt very welcomed, yeah. And I think there's a twofold benefit to that. On the one side, I think particularly after the 2016 presidential election, there's this impression of places like Macomb County as unwelcoming to people like immigrants and particularly Muslims. We also know of incidents of Islamophobia and tension that have taken place in these areas. But one of the things that's been surprising is how welcoming those communities have been to bring this programming there. And then on the other side, our hope is that the people that come and visit these exhibits will learn something new and go away with this idea of learning about who Muslims are, how diverse the community is. And then in addition to that, one step above that is the cultural contribution that Muslims have made and are currently making as well. The first show that we're exhibiting is actually an archival or historical show, which goes into the history of Muslims in Southeast Michigan, particularly in Detroit, and how that community started blossoming in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s.
Deep roots.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are unfamiliar with that history. So we're hoping that people will learn about that diversity, but also that rich history that's there as well, which is, I would argue, inseparable from Michigan history and from American history.
And Tazeen, what pieces do you think would surprise members of the Muslim American community? Let's say they walk in and go, I didn't know that.
I think it's interesting. A lot of the Muslim American community members may not realize how deep-rooted Muslim art and expression is in this area and in this country. I'm a musician, so for me, blues and jazz is a huge part of my influence. And if you think of Pharoah Sanders, Ahmad Jamal, even John Coltrane, who was influenced by Muslim theology and Islamic theology, these are people who were shaping blues and jazz, which are American, you know, music genres. So I think that would be something for people to learn, that, hey, we've been here. Muslims have been here for a very long time and have been shaping all sorts of different, you know, landscapes in America, including music and the arts.
If you've just joined us, we're talking with Razi Jaffrey and Tazeen Ayoub about Halal Metropolis. It is an artistic exploration of the many ways that Muslim culture has basically enriched public spaces and seen around Southeast Michigan. And to your point about being a musician, I'm wondering, what does that let you express, that music, that you might not, Tazeen, otherwise be able to get out?
I think really music is an expression of what your emotions are. What is the emotional journey that you are on in this world? And sometimes words aren't enough. You know, the way that you strike a chord, the way that you put a melody together, the way that you put certain chords together and create a progression, they're going to spark something in you naturally. And we all have this intuition where we hear something and a note might sound correct. And if it's incorrect, we'll hear it and we'll notice it. You know, this is a part of all humans. And I think that it's a really great way to connect to one another.
To the point of what people are going to see starting this weekend at Indus Detroit, what are some of the pieces that really jumped out at you, Tazeen? Because you're part of this national initiative, GAMA, about gathering all Muslim artists. What jumped out at you?
Right. Well, I haven't seen the pieces yet.
You haven't seen them.
So that's going to be a surprise. Yeah.
Very good. Very good. What about you, Razi? Do you have some special pieces that are very special to your heart?
Right now, I think the biggest thing that's really surprised me are the archival materials that we've been gathering over the last few months. News articles going back to the early 1900s, documents of incorporation for mosques and Muslim organizations, newsletters, articles where Muslims have appeared. You know, we have articles from the Detroit Free Press, the Detroit News, other newspapers from the area as well. And so those things for me are really exciting and fascinating, because you get an idea of how Muslims were perceived and portrayed in the media. And so that's, to me, has been the most interesting thing for this first exhibit.
And what's your ultimate hope, for both of you, for Halal Metropolis?
Our hope for Halal Metropolis is really to build bridges between the Muslim community and the greater community that's around it, integrated with it. One of the things that, you know, when you think about the current climate around Islamophobia and anti-immigration and other issues that affect Muslims directly and indirectly, the way to solve these issues or to address these issues is through culture. It's not through politics, because what you're trying to do is change hearts and minds. And that's through cultural creation. It's not through policy. And so that's one of the things that we're trying to do, is by creating culture and by highlighting the cultural contributions of Muslims in the area, that it'll ultimately have an effect on creating a positive viewpoint of Muslims, but also an understanding of a sense of nuance and complexity of who Muslims are. And then ultimately, that will lead to peace building.
And to Zina, as I think of you launching this Detroit chapter of GAMA, Gathering All Muslim Artists, I suspect you can see places for your members to be able to show what they do as this exhibition moves around Michigan.
Yeah, absolutely. That's actually how this came together. You know, myself and my husband, who are the co-directors of the Detroit chapter, were interested in gathering Muslim artists and giving them the opportunity to showcase their work. And Halal Metropolis had perfect opportunity for Muslim artists to be showcasing their work.
What kind of give us an idea of the kinds of art your members are creating?
Oh, God, there's so many different types of art. So we have musicians, we've got painters, we've got graphic designers, we've got videographers, we've got MCs, rappers, we have
poets and writers.
Poets, writers, someone who's writing comic books is part of the group, someone, foodies, culinary artists. It's all over the place.
So this is going to be, as this exhibition, as Halal Metropolis moves around Michigan, it's going to be changing. And if you see it one place, it may not be the same exhibition.
Different.
It will be different. And Tazine, you have brought your husband, Lou Fuki, here to perform a song. Before you do, talk to us a little about your music and then also about this song you're going to do for us.
Sure. So the type of music that we play is what we call Afro spirit jazz music. It's a fusion of a bunch of different types of music, but at its heart, it is spirit music. It is music that is inspired divinely, that is inspired through the soul, and that is its entire purpose is to just connect hearts.
That sounds great. Tell us about the song. What are we going to be hearing?
We are going to be playing a song called Luster. And Luster is a song that my husband and I first wrote together. It's the very first song that we wrote together before we got married. And it's a song that, on the surface level, it sounds like a very lustful, sensual type of song. But it's about the spiritual connection that we have as lovers for that which is beloved to us, that which is divine, that which is calling us to a greater calling.
Oh, well, let's take a listen now. This is Tazine Ayoub and Lou Fuki.
Luster, you are mine. Stir into my eyes. I see through your soul. Call me your divine. Call me your divine. You wonders, don't you? Don't you need this? Luster, you are mine.
Well, if that's a taste of the kinds of things we're going to be seeing in Halal Metropolis, it's really going to be very, very special. And you can find details on Halal Metropolis, including the exhibition locations and dates that go into the fall of 2020. So this is all planned out. Just go to halalmetropolis.org. Razi Jaffrey, who is one of the three co-creators, and Tazine Ayoub, founder of the Detroit chapter of Gathering All Muslim Artists, thank you for sharing your passion and your work with us.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having
us. Thank you so much.
And that's Stateside for today. Luster Graham will be here with you tomorrow, and I will be back with you Monday. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Trace my lines, I feel your gaze.